A little secret here on MTOM Podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. I get to kind of do what I want. I'm really not supposed to be that obnoxious about it, but I kind of do when it comes to this podcast. It's people that I want to talk to and that I find interesting and that maybe I've not sat down and wanted to record some comments from this person or just want to learn a little bit more. This one's going to be a little back home for me. I'm from Jessup, Iowa, which is in northeast Iowa. And I grew up on a road. It's 270th Street in Buchanan County. It's Rickard Road in Blackhawk County. Our guest today grew up on the Blackhawk County section of the road. His name is Ben Renshie. And I've always said Renshie. And I said, Ben, how do you pronounce your name? And he says, well, it depends. But I'm from the double E camp. So Ben Renshie is who we're going to have on today. And Ben is a farmer. But he hasn't always been a farmer. He graduated, as he said, from the University of Jessup, which is where I graduated from, high school. And it was the late 70s. And trying to get into the farm in the 80s after college, well, that wasn't good. And so his career took him into banking. And then a life change happened, and he ended up on the farm. And now it is a major operation, and it is known in many areas about this farm. And Ben's going to get into, we're going to talk banking and we're going to talk agriculture and knowledge and getting started and all sorts of things. But forgive us a little bit as we talk about the most famous resident from Jessup, which is Catherine Cobe. And you're like, well, who's that? Well, she was one of the hostages held for 444 days in Iran in the 70s and was released on, or the terms for her release happened on the night Ronald Reagan was inaugurated. So that's where we go, and Catherine is someone that both of us know, and maybe someday we'll talk to Catherine, but her interest in agriculture is a little different. So forgive me for this long, rambling intro of the M2M podcast, but I just wanted to put a little bit of perspective and why this might be a little homey between the two of us. We will talk all sorts of things about specializing, diversifying, the finders, the minders, and the grinders. That's today's installment of the MTOM podcast from Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Enjoy. All right, Ben, you got to settle something. Who's the second most famous person from Jessup? Because we all know Catherine Cobe is one.
Paul Yeager.
Is it you?
Paul Yeager.
Or is it me?
It's Paul Yeager.
I don't.
Always.
I don't think so.
Yep.
I've not been printed about in the Wall Street Journal.
No. I didn't set out to have that happen, but it has.
Did you think, as a kid growing up, that that's how it would all go? Did you always think farming? I mean, because after you left high school, it wasn't necessarily your destiny.
Yeah. Well, funny thing happened on the way back to the farm. I thought I was going to farm and never thought about doing anything different. And then in the fall of 1979, I went to... We better turn that off. In the fall of 1979, I went to what they called winter quarter farm op at Iowa State, a short course for those inclined to get back to farming as quick as they could, where they took all farming classes over the winter quarter. And I did that two winters in a row, and the farm economy just got worse and worse while I was in college. And unsuspecting to my parents, college agreed with me. I came back with better report cards than I had at the University of Jessup. And so at Iowa State, they said, you know, you really should just stay on and get a degree because you're not missing a lick back here, you know, in the 80s farm economy. And then we got to the end of the road in 1984. Then I graduated with a bachelor's degree. I had what I consider a very successful time at Iowa State. And my dad, who had always been on the bank board at Farmers State Bank in Jessup, kind of colluded with banker Sparky Durow and said, you should get a job. And, of course, Spark had ideas that that job should be at a bank because that'd be a good training for a banker. You know, if you're trying to wait out the farm economy, go work at a bank and get a chance to see into other people's businesses. So I did that. And I had a remarkable set of experiences. I first worked at Bankers Trust in downtown Des Moines in the basement of what was Iowa's tallest building then, the Ruan Center. And I literally was in the basement with the rest of the credit analysts. And I had a remarkable time there. John Crystal was the president of the bank. And I remember going to loan committee and getting documents ready for Mr. Crystal and all the bank vice presidents. And it was, you know, a very challenging time for farmers. A lot of people who were very good at this business couldn't make the numbers work. And that was quite a wake-up call for me to see that. But they taught me to read and analyze financial statements. I worked there a year, and when I was coming out of college, I managed my opportunities well. And I have to admit, I got very close to, at that time, Norwest, or what's now Wells Fargo Bank, and they weren't hiring. But they were interested in me, and they reached out to me after I had a year of banking experience and offered me what was kind of my dream job. And so I went across the street, more or less, or down the street a block, and worked for what used to be the old Iowa Des Moines National Bank. And I worked in the credit department for Norwest, or what's now Wells Fargo. And I spent a year there. And then they sent me up to Fort Dodge. Mainly the business there was in 1986-87 was to work with troubled ag loans. And that was just the low water mark in the farm economy. You know, it was heartbreaking to see people who worked so hard and were so good at their craft couldn't get the value for their crops and livestock that it took to pay their obligations. Interest rates had gone through the roof in the past half a dozen years. Things that usually look like safe opportunities for farmers, like buying the farm next door, became virtual anchors on farmers' financial well-being. Things just happened. It was COVID-19 for farmers in that period.
Right.
You know, you just couldn't see it all coming. And I worked there and learned a lot more. But I realized at that time that if I wanted to stay in, I didn't know when I'd be able to come back to farming. It looked so bleak.
Because at that time, how old's your dad at that point?
He would have been 56, 57.
Yeah. So not time to retire yet.
Oh, no.
And it's not time to enter the business yet.
Right. Right. In our family, retirement usually comes when your odometer is well into the eights, if not the nines. So I thought about it. And one of the internships I had during college put me in close contact and sharing an apartment in Logan, Utah, with a young rancher by name of John Maddox. And John's dad was a very, very businesslike rancher from Imperial, Nebraska, Juanita, Nebraska. And he'd encouraged John to go to business school. He said, you know, if you're going to run a big ranch, translate to me big farm, you need a business education. You need to know marketing, finance, operations, human resource management. And so John went to MBA school at the University of Chicago. And I went out and visited John, and I visited some other business schools, and I put together my application. And that was a very successful time. And I got accepted by several business schools, and I went to University of Chicago, and I got my MBA there. And still the time wasn't right to come back to farming, and it just seemed like with that tool in my kit that what I should do is try and go use it in banking, which I had really gotten quite an affinity for. I really enjoyed the work and the people and, you know, seeing other businesses and evaluating them. And, you know, in banking, there's basically three jobs. They're called finders, minders, and grinders. And finders are the old vice presidents who ride around in jets and go tee off at fancy golf courses and slap each other on the back with the corporate treasurer and president and get the deal. And then there's the minders, which are the 40-year-old vice presidents that kind of get the details done. Well, the grinders in the late 80s, early 90s had their IBM PC on their desk and did spreadsheets and figured out how to make the deal work. And I kind of graduated from grinder to minder in that phase. But most of the time I was in banking, I was a grinder, just looking at other people's deals. And so when I got out of University of Chicago, I made a connection because the recruiting department of the University of Chicago, the job placement department, was just fantastic. And I ended up working for a Swiss bank, one of the heritage banks that went into what's now UBS. I worked for Swiss Bank Corporation, and I worked in corporate finance for them. And I got to work in New York City. I got to work on Wall Street. I worked in Four World Trade, one of the short buildings that went down in the 9/11 event. I got to work in Basel, Switzerland. I got to travel all over the United States, and it was just a fantastic experience. But I did that until the early 90s, and then tragedy brought me home. My younger brother, who had also gone to Iowa State, went right back to the farm, and we lost my brother in an auto accident during harvest time when he was on his way to a field, right on the same road we grew up on, Paul. And so instantly my decision was set. I was going to come back and keep our farm so it had another generation. And so I've been back here since the early 90s and raised my family of four kids, and have transitioned our farm from a diversified crop and livestock farm. One thing I learned as a business analyst is that most businesses, as they mature, tend to specialize. And looking, I can see why it happened. I didn't understand it at the time, but our business, you know, the technology and crop production has just gotten so sophisticated. And I just realized that we didn't have the capital or the resources or the manpower developed to be, you know, good at five things. I mean, I often, when I tell the story of our farm, I said, especially to non-farmer people, that the success of my grandfather's farm was we had four or five kinds of crops and four or five types of critters, and we really didn't have to be perfect at any of them. You know, one of them was always having a very good year, and one of them was, you know, not. But it all balanced out. Well, now we're down to really growing grain, two crops, corn and soybeans, and you have to be absolutely perfect at them to stay in this business. And if you're going to use all the tools and technology, you're going to, you know, not have as much time to be a small-scale livestock producer or a large-scale livestock producer. But what we do is, since we've got the latest technology, we do a fair amount of custom application and work for other neighbors that have prolonged their careers in agriculture. We put on fertilizer, we put on crop care products, herbicide, and fungicide. We help a lot of other people with their businesses that with the specialized equipment that we have.
You know, you bring up a whole number of things there that I sure would like to dive into. And I do remember your brother that exact day when sitting behind me, our old the gal that lived between us. I was in the same English class with Carrie Zook, and she had gotten a call about what had happened. And it was one of those things. And strategy has a weird way of kind of lining things up. But if you go back to what you're talking about with specialize and diversify, because your agronomy side sounds more like I'm growing chickens and turkeys, because agronomy and custom application to me and to some don't always say, well, that's not raising corn or soybeans. That's a diversification. But then I sit and read trade stories about, well, we need to diversify our trading partners and not be reliant on one. Well, we've been perfect with one, but maybe we could be perfect with a whole bunch. I don't know how any of it makes sense anymore, Ben, from when you started to what you learned in banking to what you're doing now in agriculture. How do you ever sit back and just go, listening to yourself tell that story, go, wait a minute, how did I get from there to here? And why is it different and why is it the same?
Did you hide a question in that?
No, I didn't. I didn't. And that's what I wanted to – but I mean, that's – it just is an interesting evolution of agriculture. I mean, would you say that the biggest change has happened in the last 30 years, or was it in the 30 years before that?
I'd say it's gone on fast forward, Paul, in the past 10. And
why?
And you know, it actually is a little perplexing to a lot of people. One of the beauties of this business, what I learned compared to being a business analyst at the bank, is that it just doesn't feel to me like there's as many ways to run a hardware store or a retail business or a restaurant as there are to farm. You can pursue this business a lot of different ways and still be successful. You can be successful because of your gifted talents to keep machinery running. You can be successful because your ability to raise livestock or to work with your production strategy and find the perfect way to raise crops on the soils and in the weather patterns of your area. You know, there's just so many ways to do this, and you can pursue it on so many different sizes and scales. And, you know, there's families that can collaborate, and you see, a handful of brothers or cousins or siblings or multi-generational partners work together, and they have one big farm instead of several small ones. And then, as you know, in our area, there's several, you know, siblings that farm, but they all have their own farm and they do great too. I mean, you can just organize to however it fits you best. And so, you just don't know what's going to come. I think the biggest change in agriculture for me has been the technology that's been available to change our crop production in the past 10 years. The ability to gather data and make better decisions, the ability to change your production strategy, because up until 15 years ago, you were still kind of looking at a way to get the seed in the ground and to kill the pests that harm it. And now, you know, just look at all the ways you can shop for better markets for your grain or decommoditize what you grow. Or, use a different production strategy. Just the different ways that we spoon feed crops now, instead of feed them Thanksgiving dinner, one big dump of fertilizer all at once and expect it to last all season. We often see it with our custom application clients, that the few neighbors that we help, we spray their crops for them, that once they unplug, it's only a season or two before they really can't follow all the developments of what you can do with a crop to keep the pests out as the pest spectrum keeps moving and the fertilization program. They just, you know, the new options, it's amazing. I feel the same way in livestock production. It hasn't been that long since I was a pork producer. And now I pick up some periodical. I'm reading something about pork production. I realize how woefully out of date I am. I'm lost. I'm glad I got good friends who do that, so that can keep me kind of primed. So,
who takes all the information? I mean, is that one person that you have on staff that can do it? Is that something that you've been able to do with an analytical brain and use it? I mean, you got a lot of acres and you got a lot of things in the air, Ben. How do you
and
make it work?
It's been all me, but, we've had a little transition in our business this year. My father passed away in June, and replacing my father, so to speak, is my son-in-law, Luke Gossi, you know. And Luke is great at technology and understanding these, and he's a great technology implementation partner. We've got some external consultants that write prescriptions for our seeding and fertility and that are great on this. Help us with crop insurance records, help us in dealing. And then a lot of vendors will help you on this too. I mean, they want to sell their product. All the ERP software, all the equipment management platforms that are available. I mean, they don't come unsupported. They can be massively frustrating. If I told you what I wanted to do, it'd be murder one. So we'll stick to manslaughter.
Yeah, that's right.
But, at the end of the day, we those people can be very helpful. They have a very complex task because their products change so much, but you almost have to use them as part of the formula.
Well, you go to the late 70s, graduating high school, and what farming looked like and what farming got into, it was basically one thing. You look like your dad, look like my dad. Now think about your kids when they graduated high school and then go to college, some still in college, that life or the career changed, because just because they want to get an agriculture doesn't mean they're going to be sitting there in Blackhawk County working on your farm. They might be one of those vendors. That might be their way in and their contribution to agriculture. Did you think that those types of jobs were out there in the late 70s, early 80s, like there are now of those vendors and suppliers?
Well, back when we were a diversified farm with diverse, with many kinds of livestock and crops, my interface was really just the sales force out there. And no, I wasn't aware. I wasn't aware of what was available and that it was tangible to have a job in a company. And college changed that for me, where I got to peek behind the curtain and see how the companies were run. And, all four of my children are involved in agriculture in some way. They love it, and they're all welcome to come back. I think we'll have over a 50% retention ratio on that one. So
so you've got one back now?
Well, my oldest daughter, Lauren, works for Indigo Agriculture. And, of course, in the 2020ing of everything, she's working from home now. My son-in-law, Luke Gossi, farms with me and really has assumed day-to-day management of our workforce and, we share decision-making. I've got a daughter, Hannah, who has spent most of a decade since she was in her mid-teens working at the Independence Monsanto Research Farm. She spent most of the decade with Bayer, and she's going over to BASF in Southeast Iowa in just a matter of days. So she's been with agronomy and the seed business, and now she's going to the ag chem protection business. So we're excited about that opportunity for her. My son Hans is a senior at Iowa's finest university, public university.
There you go.
We all know what Iowa's finest private university is at. It's in Waverly, Iowa, which our family is very fond of Wartburg College. My older sister went there. She's even on the Board of Regents.
She is on the Board of Regents. We have good conversations when we see each other.
Yeah, so I know Wartburg's biggest mistake, but anyway. But it's a great, wonderful school that we support warmly. But we're big Cyclone fans here. My wife and I are both graduates, and my son Hans is a senior at Iowa State in agribusiness and agriculture business and international agriculture. And if I do say so myself, he's done quite well in his college career. And he has worked for the past four summers, three of them he's worked for BASF as an intern, and before that he had a World Food Prize internship in China. So very proud of Hans and his accomplishments. And then my youngest daughter just graduated from Jessup High School, or also known to you and me as the University of Jessup.
That's right.
She graduated and has elected to take a gap year before going to college. She didn't want to go to a Zoom university, and she plans and has been accepted by Stanford University and will go to Stanford this fall. So University of Chicago for me and my oldest daughter, Cornell University for my middle daughter, Hannah, Hans and I share Iowa State, and then Faith will go to Stanford. So really excited about that opportunity the kids have.
So education is just kind of a thing. It's just not really, it just kind of
happens.
I mean, those are incredible institutions.
Happens, yeah, they are. I'm very proud of the children and what they've achieved. And what can you say?
What can you say, but you're proud? And okay, I sometimes get into this, and I think it's always a discussion that people have, and some are better at it than others. What's that conversation been like? You said if you can get your retention rate, your retention rate might be pretty good. What if they all do want to come back? Have you had those conversations about how you enter back in, how it works? Do you take the Vermeer approach where they had to go work somewhere else before they could come back into the manufacturing company? I mean, what's that been like? That discussion.
Yeah, you know, we've had the 5-year rule. You need to go work somewhere else, and we even held that over son-in-law Luke, who worked with Rabo AgriFinance and Farm Credit Services before joining our farm. That heavens, I don't want to be the kids' first boss. I mean, let somebody else rub their nose in it when they need it, you know. But I think it's a great idea to send your kids out to earn their first promotion, live on their paycheck, get told after they work really hard on something that isn't what the boss wanted, and get turned down by a client and get approved by win a big client, or, you know, approve the boss's approval. And I think those are all lessons that pretty valuable. I've always loved having students work at our farm. Our farm is very close to Hawkeye Community College. We've always had a couple Hawkeye Community College students work for us over the past 28 years. We provided internships, and we'll work with student hours, and that's been a fantastic experience. So more recently, we've added a little international dimension to this. We've had young farmers from Germany, England, Hungary, and Brazil come join us for a season as J-1 visa holders. That's been exciting, and it's kind of sharpened both my and my crew's game that it gives us a dimension that, we're constantly in training mode. It kind of gets us out of the rut that you hear from a lot of farmers. There's no help available. Well, maybe it's just not fun to train people who don't have experience is what the real problem is. Or, you know, if you have a family work environment, if you have a farm that's all family labor, it's pretty easy for a family to align goals. Like, we're going to work really hard and get the hay up by Thursday so we can go fishing Friday, Saturday, or, you know, whatever, snowmobiling or something like that. We're going to get the grain all hauled. When you involve non-family partners and, or, you know, employees into your team, you know, you've got to change your ways. You've got to be able to tell an employee's spouse that we will not be working this weekend so they can plan family events and figure out a way to get the farm work done anyway. And, you know, people want reasonable hours. People want to feel like they're constantly improving, or, you know, have chances to better themselves or be promoted. That's a little perplexing on a farm because the work's the same. The technology keeps getting better, but you have to give people the sort of sense that you're including them in the latest decisions you make and the best opportunities you can give them. You've got to compete with jobs. You know, we're close to Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and, you know, those jobs offer insurance and retirement savings and benefits, and you've got to keep that in mind with your own workforce.
Oh, it's like any business. Yep. I mean, you have to pay to be competitive and have a good working environment. I mean, it's just because it's a farm doesn't mean it can't be like every other business. Do you think of farming as a business?
Always.
Yeah. I mean, what about those that will say, oh, it's a passion. You can have business and still be a family farm, right?
Well, you can feel that way, but having been a business analyst for about a dozen years before I was a farmer, people feel passionate about their stores. People feel passionate about their restaurants. People feel about their career at a Fortune 500 company. So we like to claim that as our own in agriculture, but, to let the cat out of the bag, a lot of people feel that. I bet you even journalists in Des Moines feel that way. They're passionate about what they do.
They might. Yeah. They might. Some, a couple. some right now are kind of going, seriously, when is any of this going to end so they can go back to telling stories? Who would have thought that they want to go back and tell stories about tax increment finance over COVID or an election? But that's sometimes what you had to do. Yeah. You don't miss the TIF days?
No. You know, a long time ago, one of my banking colleagues at Norwest in Des Moines, you know, called me up after I'd been home farming for about a year or two and just really thought I'd be the right person for a job they had at the bank. And somewhere in the conversation, he said, "You figured it out. You want to be on the other side of the desk. I'm not ever going to get you back here, am I?" And you make that decision somewhere along the way.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Do you ever pine for the days of going into a high rise or somewhere in Switzerland or Chicago?
So far, just about every day in 2021, that looked, or 2020, that looked better. You know, I got to admit, this was the year that finally tripped it. That is kind of like, well, wouldn't be bad going to a bank, would it? But they're not even really at the bank either. They're just, you know, one Zoom meeting after another and trying to get clients to go along with that scheme.
I was on the phone with a banker friend this morning and we were talking about that exact thing. He says, "I can do this for two more months, but I just don't know if I can keep doing it much longer trying to find." He's one of those finders out trying to find business. And we were talking about the restaurant industry and, you know, closing it at 10 seems obscene for some people, absurd for some people and reasonable to others. And that's been, you know, trying to sort all of this out about what's reasonable and what's your right and what's your civic duty is, it's been a tough thing to navigate.
Yeah, last night I was at a restaurant. We were there at 9:50 and I said, "Boy, I better get home. If I stay here till 10, I might get COVID."
Yeah. Well, I mean, we know what happens in bars after 10 o'clock, and I think that's what they're going for, but...
No, I don't, Paul. Maybe things are different at Wartburg. What happens up there at the Angel Factory?
Well, Joe's doesn't even turn the music on until 10 o'clock, I think. He doesn't have the DJ until that
I was at the library at Iowa State at that hour, you know, and there was still a couple more hours to get, you know, ready for tomorrow's test.
That's good. That's why you're where you're at, and that's where I'm at. I guess you studied harder than I did. Same with my wife. You know, when you sit back and you look at things and you wonder, gosh, 2020 was just makes you want to do something different. When you look to 2021, I'd say take out COVID as a discussion, but we know that's going to be hanging over our head in all industries. What are you hopeful for in 2021?
Well, you know, I think 2020, to borrow a term from the World Economic Forum, is going to turn out to be the Great Reset. I mean, we found out a lot of things. I mean, we found out we can do a lot of things electronically that we used to think we had to do face-to-face. And that's going to be, you know, we can order things online. We can arrange business. We can communicate this way. Those things are probably going to turn out to be big positives for agriculture. Right now, my production system, I'm in the commodity corn and soybean production business. Margins are razor thin. And, you know, really, if our suppliers, you know, they can really, they found out that they didn't have to do things as traditional as they thought. They thought, you know, it looks like there could be real streamlining of the grain, you know, the input supply business. There could be streamlining of the delivery process to go right to your farm. There could be streamlining of the grain buying process. I mean, there's just a lot of things that we found out. You know, you just find out what's really essential and not. It's kind of like what's essential to the essential worker.
Well, and streamlining is a word that scares people. Because they see, well, my job or my take or my cut is in the line of fire and gone. But just like it came out of the 80s and it came out of the recession in 08 and to 10, we're going to see new jobs appear. People are finding that, you know what, I don't want to work for somebody else. I want to work for myself because I see a niche here that can be fit. I mean, I was just, again, back to my banker story. He's a little younger than I am. And I said, I don't know if you remember Waterloo Cedar Falls in the 80s. When deers, that's what we call it in our neck of the woods, right? And that deer and company. When those layoffs happened, there were workers that had to go find something else to do because they knew their job wasn't coming back. And they went into a different kind of business and never looked back. Sometimes entrepreneurship comes out of some dark times, and maybe that's what's going to happen in 21.
Well, I lament on some days that I can't have my grandfather's diversified livestock farm, but there's not much point in having a small poultry operation at my farm or having sheep to graze down the grove. These are great businesses if, you know, you pursue them robustly, but, you know, to do everything on a small scale and in an imperfect way is just isn't realistic. And, you know, to your original point, streamlining is going to change opportunities for people, but it's inevitable. I mean, it's just happening in fast forward. I don't think we're going to need near the sales force to sell goods and services to agriculture, but Lord knows, you know, these people are all needed on the product development and research side. I mean, one thing I see with input suppliers in farming right now is a lot of the people who supply me now kind of came of age during the commodity boom of 10 years ago. And, you know, whether they realize it or not, they're kind of, you know, default value is those farmers have the money. We just aren't grabbing them by the heels and shaking them upside down hard enough yet. There's got to be more money in there. Pretty sure that's what most equipment dealers think right now. And seed salesmen and chem salesmen and fertilizer people aren't, you know, not guilty of this. Anyway, you know, I remember those that supplied me coming out of the 80s really had to look for systems that provided value and opportunities with margin for me. And just watch. Here's my bet. We see that over the next 5 years, that if you're going to make if you're going to supply to a farmer now, you're going to bring farmers opportunities to be more profitable. And then, you know, as a farmer, it's your job to implement, you know, sort out the opportunities and implement them. But if you think you're just going to farm and pursue this on a, you know, like everybody else, you're probably going to live on pretty slim margins. I mean, unless you're, you know, married a few extra quarters of land or, you know, a few dead uncles, you know, it might be okay if they left you in the well. I don't know. So.
Yeah. Well, what do you say if you're someone, I mean, let's go with your foreign workers or maybe the guy, the kids that come out of Hawkeye, someone who doesn't have any of those opportunities to get into agriculture. What's their chance? What's their opportunity? How do they get in to do?
Well, let's think about that. The opportunity to be a traditional independent producer is probably a tough one, you know, because this is such a capital intensive business. But literally, our farm is just drowning in data. We have a database back to 1997 of all the crops we harvested, what made it work. We have precision agriculture opportunities in our crop farm, and I'm sure it's the same in the livestock business, whether you dairy or pork production or feed cattle in Iowa. There's all kinds of opportunity to manage that data and help the farmer make better decisions. Scouting, I can tell you right now, big fan of using the minimal inputs it takes to raise a crop and being the best stewards of our land, the best pastoral care of our land. But I can tell you right now that some of my present suppliers struggle to find young workers to go out and scout fields. And that's just an essential learning process. Machinery keeps getting more sophisticated. I don't know. Paul, in your business right now, if you wanted to be a journalist, you couldn't start your own TV station. You might get a YouTube channel, but, you know, mm-hmm. You work for a very successful enterprise, with IPTV and found your niche and enjoy working for them. And they give you, obviously, a wonderful spot to, practice your craft. I don't know why it's any different in agriculture. You might not ever be a, own your own standalone farm. But there's just a wealth of opportunity to do important things in this business.
Well, you know, journalism wise, if I can just explain a little of, unpack kind of what you just said, I can think of just in my short time, stations that used to have a bigger force. We'll call them the big seed company or the big machinery company, the one that you'd heard of. And there's been layoffs because of streamlined, because we don't need someone to process film anymore, or we don't need somebody to edit tape because the person can shoot the video, can edit the video, and hit play. Yes, I could start my own YouTube channel. I could become an influencer, but you can't just make a viral video. You got to get a little bit of luck, but you got to have what's luck? Opportunity meets hard work. I mean, you got to still put it in. You got to know what the skill is, no matter what it is. If you're selling insurance, buying insurance, working in banking, working in journalism, you still have to put in the time to get to where you want to be. And yeah, let's take a little bit of luck. I always say I'd rather be lucky than good.
Well, you need to read your Malcolm Gladwell books, you know, What the Dog Saw. You know, you put in your 10,000 hours, you know, all of a sudden luck gets a lot easier is what those books.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, don't be dropping Malcolm Gladwell to some people. They'll think that you spent a little too much time in Europe or something.
Yeah, well.
He's fascinating.
Yeah, I don't read as many books as I should, but I did enjoy those. So
I do listen to some of his podcasts. I will admit I don't always get all the books. All right, last question. Are you from Jessup or are you from Jubilee?
That's not even a question. You know, I'm technically from Jubilee Heights, the uppity suburb of Jubilee. But what you're referring to is Jubilee. Jubilee was a small town that existed partially on the corner of our home farm. The general store was on the corner of our home farm. And there was a meat market, a blacksmith shop, and a creamery all there. And down the road a little bit at the next four corners south was the Lutheran church, still there, Zion Lutheran. And there was a Lutheran school, but the city, the community fathers back then were clever enough to entice the community school to locate right across from the church. So, you know, those clever Lutherans, they thought of a way to have tax dollars put the school right across from the church so they didn't have to fund it all themselves. And my father went there. My father went there through eighth grade, and the school closed in 1961. But, yeah, the once existent town of Jubilee was partially on the corner of our home farm, and pictures of it are displayed in our conference room. And I believe the legend says that when the railroad went through Jessup instead of Jubilee, that was the start of the future fate of Jubilee. So
it's amazing how even towns today that are on the rail line that aren't, and when the railroad leaves, so does the town.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago we had harvest shirts made for the crew, and it, you know, it said Blue Diamond Farming Company World Harvest Tour, and then we listed all the non-existent towns, you know, Jubilee, Enterprise, Buzzard's Glory, all the places we played, so to speak. So.
Was Shady Grove on that
show? Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, I am not from Shady Grove, although I have land holdings in the major, in the Shady Grove metro area. Pretty proud of that.
Yeah.
Shady Grove is one cool town. It's kind of my second hometown.
All right. Well, we'll take that. So we got somebody from Jubilee and somebody from Shady Grove, all studied at the University of Jessup. Ben, thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Paul.
My thank you to Ben Rienshi for the time today, as you can always send me an email, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Love to talk to you. Give me a call, write, whatever. Thanks for listening.